Hello, everyone. It is Saturday, the 14th of November, 3 days before the publication of a really marvelous, almost miraculous, in fact, novel, because some of the contributors are no longer with us. It's called Whodunit. It is a project of the Detection Club, which I think, and Martin Edwards, the current president who will be running this meeting, can correct me, is the longest running social club, if not professional club, for crime writers. Certainly in the United Kingdom. His past presidents have included such luminaries as Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, H.R.F. Keating, Simon Brett, and currently Martin Edwards. It's a wonderful group. I've been privileged to attend some of its meetings as a guest. In fact, Martin, I was there when Simon Brett was sworn in with the,
Oh,
as the president. So, that was at the Savoy, the famous night I wound up sitting in the ladies' room with P.D. James for 15 minutes because she didn't want to go back. It was my most intimate conversation with P.D. James all the way around. In any case, they have produced this wonderful book called Whodunit, which publishes on Tuesday here in the United States from HarperCollins. And I urge anyone who is an aspiring writer, a published writer, or a reader who is interested in the writing process to acquire a copy because the essays from the members are really spectacular. And Martin is not only president of the Detection Club, but is the editor of this wonderful project. So I'm now going to hand off this conversation to him. Thank you, Martin.
Thanks very much, Barbara, and thanks very much for hosting this discussion. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined today by three of my wonderful colleagues in the Detection Club, Ellie Griffiths, Andrew Taylor, and Aline Templeton, and they will be having plenty to say about their contributions and about their experience of the Detection Club and about the craft of writing in general. But I thought that first I would start by saying just a little about the project and how this book came to be. The Detection Club, as Barbara says, has an illustrious history, dates back to 1930. So this year it was celebrating its 90th birthday. The celebrations, of course, have not been quite as vociferous or as exciting as we'd anticipated, for reasons that everyone will understand, but there's always another day, there's always another year, and there's always another Detection Club get together and Detection Club dinner. And I was interested as president in the idea of producing a book that would celebrate that rather splendid and special anniversary. And I had the idea of producing a book that was a little bit different from the earlier Detection Club publications. Over the years, the Detection Club has produced quite a number of books. The first, as early as 1931, when G.K. Chesterton, the very first president of the Detection Club, and Dorothy L. Sayers, and Agatha Christie, Anthony Barclay, and others collaborated in a novel called The Floating Admiral, which is still in print today, quite something. It's still in print in various different languages as well. And that was so successful that it led to quite a number of other books being produced in the 1930s. And the books have come out intermittently since then, really to shore up the club's finances because it's a small dining club. It's a not-for-profit organisation, of course, funded by member subscriptions and by the proceeds, the royalties of the books that we produce. So it was high time that we brought out another volume. And so I pitched to the members the idea of a book about the art and craft of writing detective fiction, because who better than the members of the Detection Club to produce such a book? And I envisaged that perhaps 15, 20 members might be persuaded or have their arms twisted to contribute, and that would make up a book. And it would be not just how done it, but how we did it. It would be an insight into different writing styles, different methods, different approaches to all the different aspects of writing crime. And I thought we'd also include a number of pieces by former members, deceased members, including Agatha Christie and Dorothy L. Sayers, to show that things have changed in crime fiction, but some of them haven't changed quite as much as you might imagine. Well, I was delighted that the members were enthusiastic about the idea, and we pitched it to HarperCollins, who published a number of Detection Club books over the years, and we decided to call it Whodunit. And so I started that arm twisting process. And to my surprise and delight, the members were not only willing to have their arms twisted, they came up with some absolutely fantastic material. And more manuscripts came in. More arms were twisted, more emails were sent out. And in the end, almost every living member of the club, including a number who've not written for a good many years, contributed, over 60 people, with a total of over 90 contributors, plus myself as editor, covering all aspects of the craft of crime writing. And we decided to dedicate the book to Len Dayton, the wonderful Len, who's not published a new novel for quite a long time, but has been a member of the Detection Club for 50 years. Think about that, 50 years, a member of this club. And he was excited by the idea, and he has contributed a wonderful essay, which is the very last thing in the book, which is all about his own career as a crime writer. He's also contributed some wonderful items from his own personal library, photographs of his working methods, and also of a dinner that he attended with Ian Fleming, of course, the creator of James Bond. So one of the rules I set for myself when editing this book was to edit with a very, very light touch. And I was conscious that authors would all have their own individual voices. I wanted those voices to be heard. There were bound to be differences of view. And of course, one of the great differences in crime writing is the divide between those who plot a novel and those who fly by the seat of their pants. And we have both perspectives in Whodunit, different authors explaining how they go about it. Kate Ellis has written a wonderful piece illustrated by one of her flowcharts as to how she plans so meticulously her wonderful novels. But there is also a piece by Andrew Taylor, which deals with his own approach to writing a crime novel. And I wonder, Andrew, if you'd like to tell us a little bit about that, please.
It's not really an approach. It's more really a series of blunderings. When I came to write my first novel, I was trying to write my first novel for years and years, literally about 5 years. And I just couldn't, my big stumbling block was I couldn't plan it. I just couldn't somehow, I didn't have the sort of brain that could sit down and think, well, okay, in chapter one, this will happen, chapter two, that will happen, and so on to the end. I knew it to be a crime novel, and I knew, you know, certain things, certain themes interested me. But I had no idea of the storyline, and I had a moment of truth. I was working in a public library at the time, and one February lunchtime, it was raining, I was very depressed, and I had this feeling, if I didn't actually start writing a novel, wherever it went, at that very moment, I'd never write a novel at all. And I just picked up a biro and a sheet of A4, and I wrote right through my lunchtime. I wrote 7 pages, which eventually became the first 7 pages of my first novel, Caroline Minuscule. And at that, during that lunchtime, I made the miraculous discovery that each sentence has the germ of the next sentence within it, and so on, and so on. The third sentence has the germ of the fourth. Then you have a paragraph. Ooh, and then you can move on to the next paragraph. It all has an internal logic that once you tap into that, you can just follow it where it goes. Now, obviously, as I went through that first novel, I learned you have to sort of somehow touch the current this way or that and direct it. But always the important thing is to keep that forward motion. I was listening to David Mitchell, the novelist, on the radio yesterday, and he said the best advice you can give a first-time novelist is to get to the end of a book, because once you've got a whole book, you can apply a completely different part of your mind to it. You can use the analytical part of your mind, because you've got the whole thing there. You can see which part you need to tweak. But what I discovered with that first novel was that you don't have to use the analytical part. You shouldn't, well, in my case, you shouldn't use the analytical part until you finish the thing. It comes afterwards. As Reginald Hill, the late, great, wonderful Reginald Hill once said, the plot is something I put in afterwards. And when he said that, I just cheered. I mean, this is exactly my approach. You get the book out there and then you put the plot in. God bless Reginald Hill, that's what I think.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thanks, Andrew. Now, Ellie, you talk in the book about something different. We'll come on to that a bit later. But I wonder how you approach the project of writing your own wonderful novels.
Oh, thank you. First of all, I'm so sorry about my cat. That's what happened. He was meowing outside, had to let him in, then he stood on the keyboard, and he's just there at the moment. But anyhow, if the screen goes black, it's not me. It's because he's a black cat and he stands in front of the screen. So yeah, my first tip is don't have a cat. No, do have a cat. But don't kill the cat. I think we can all agree on that. That's the one thing a crime novelist should never do. So interesting to hear you talk, Andrew, and to read your piece in How Done It, which is sort of about how to change the murderer, isn't it? Sort of, which I was kind of surprised to read Agatha Christie did sometimes, and I read her notebooks, that sometimes she would change who did it halfway through the book, which just think, oh, who's the most unlikely? Which is really, as Andrew described it then, was quite freeing, because you thought, oh, well, if she did that. I guess I'm halfway between... Martin, your description of being a planner. Sometimes people say plan or pantser, don't they? Someone who flies by the seat of their pants or someone who plans. And I guess I'm kind of halfway through in that I usually do a kind of just a chapter outline, a few pages for a few lines for each chapter. And then as I go through the book, I do change it, you know, as I go along, and it's a bit like having a map, but it's not a sat nav, so it's just a map, so you can go off and you can detour. And there's that wonderful quotation, Andrew, in your piece, and who said it? They said, writing a book's like driving at night. You can only see as far as your headlights go, but you can finish your journey like that. Who said that, Andrew?
That was E.L. Doctorow.
Oh, it was E.L. Doctorow, and you quote it in your piece, and that's, I think that's... You attributed it, that's fine. So I think, you know, I think that's something to remember, really. And now when I write, I don't do a written plan at all. I just try and keep it in my head and try when I finish each chapter to write a little bit of the next one so I know what's going to happen. So I try, I suppose, to sort of have faith in it. And just to follow on from David Mitchell's advice, as somebody said to me very early on, that you can fix a bad page, but you can't fix a blank page. So just get it all down there.
Wise words. How about you, Aline? What's your approach?
Well, it's interesting that you picked up on the Andrew's point about changing the murderer, because I did actually write a book and get to the third, what I thought was going to be the third last chapter, and I suddenly thought, but he didn't do it. And I suddenly thought, of course he didn't do it. It was the other one. And it all just seemed fine. And I thought, no, I've got to go back and bring that murderer more into focus. But when I started reading it, I realised it was all there. It was actually quite complete. And one half of my brain had been working one way and the other half had been working the other way. And once I changed the murderer, that was fine. It's never happened to me again. But I started writing because it was just the most natural thing in the world. I completed my first novel at the age of six, which was the story of two elf persons who went off to Paris together for the weekend and they were called Mr. Wiz and Mrs. Woz. And I didn't actually disclose what Mr. Woz and Mrs. Wiz thought was going on. But I should really have gone on writing blockbusters, I think. But my mother laughed so much that she laughed with tears ran down her cheeks, which rather put me off the idea. So after that, I took to crime, and that's all you really do. So it took me a certain amount of time to work out how to get it published. I have an unrivaled set of rejection slips. If I'd been wise enough to keep them, I could have sort of papered the bathroom. But the thing was, I didn't realise it was supposed to be so difficult. And in the days when I started doing it, there weren't all these courses and how-tos, all the rest of it. I just wrote, and I got a book published. I realised afterwards it wasn't a brilliant book, and I never let them reprint it. But once I realised how to get through it, that was fine. And it was only later I realised that there were all these things you were supposed to look for, like a narrative arc. Now, I wrote several books before I'd even heard of a narrative arc. And you know, where you have this climax here, climax there, all the rest of it. And the remarkable thing was, afterwards, when I did know all these things I was supposed to do, I find actually they happened anyway. And I said, I think in How Done It, I said it was like the bourgeois gentilhomme, when he was very, wanted to be very sophisticated. And he was thrilled when he discovered that when he'd been talking, he was actually talking prose. And he didn't know it was prose. And I felt very much like that. I was terribly chuffed when I found that. But Andrew, the other thing you said, which absolutely chimed me, I say this all the time, every time I get into a mess with the book, I say, trust the story. And I don't usually know exactly where it's going, because if I did, I'd get bored. I have to tell myself the story. And that's what draws me on. Sometimes I've not much idea how it'll end. Mostly I think I know, but it isn't always obliging. But just pants on seats. You can't write. I think it was Ruth Dudley Edwards who said, you know, you can't be a crime writer unless you write a crime novel. Just sit down and get on with it. And I have to say, when a new writer says, what advice do you have? I always say, apply a seat of pants to a seat of chair.
I remember hearing Frank Cottrell Boyce talking, you know, the script writer, and he said, no one comes out of a film saying, what a great narrative arc. You always come out saying, wasn't that amazing, that scene at the theatre or the scene with the parents? You remember the scene, so I try and tell myself that sometimes.
Well, so, I think, myself, I think a very useful tip, if you're trying to write a crime novel, is you simply start with the body. I mean, it's so blindingly simple, but once you've got a body in your first paragraph, and I've done this, I did this with my first novel, once you've got a body there, you've got a story. Because obviously you have to know whose is the body, how did it die? Was it murder? If so, who did it? You know, the questions spiral out from that simple fact of a corpse on the carpet, and you can go anywhere with it. So I recommend a body. Sorry, Nathan, I interrupted.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that in terms of books about writing crime fiction, I've got a whole stack of them. I've not read all of them, but I've certainly acquired a lot of them over the years. And I've always thought that one of the difficulties with some of those books, there's some very good ones, some. And indeed one or two by Harry Keating, for instance, former president of the Detection Club. I quote, that's the one writing crime fiction.
Yes, actually, I read that.
I quote in How Done It several times. That's a very good, pithy and very, very wise, as you'd expect with such a fine writer, very wise guide. But of course, the difficulty with these single author books is that it's essentially one point of view. And for me, the joy, certainly, of reading the manuscripts as they came in was to see all the different approaches taken by my friends and colleagues in the club, some of them diametrically opposed. We've spoken about plot, but in all kinds of other ways. And it's this contradiction that that I think is part of the appeal, because there is no one right way for writing a crime story. But it's a question of what's right for the individual. And I think that's one of the points that comes across very clearly. And that contrast in ideas is I think something that when people read the book, people who are wanting to write a crime novel or maybe want to do more work, having written one or two, I think they'll gain a lot of encouragement and enthusiasm from that. I also hope the book will be of interest to people who've got no desire to write crime fiction, but are just interested in how some of their favourite authors go about it. There's a whole range of things. There's correspondence between Dorothy L. Sayers and a scientist with whom she wrote one novel, her only novel not featuring Lord Peter Wimsey. And to me, that's a fascinating account of the roller coaster of emotions that many writers experience when they're actually writing the book. And sometimes it's going well, and sometimes you feel it's never gonna be publishable. And it's a question of viewpoint, which brings me to the question of viewpoint in narrative. And that's something that you've talked about, Aline. And I wonder if you'd like to say a little about your approach to the different possibilities that viewpoint offers to a writer.
I do use several viewpoints in any book. I choose when I go into a scene which person I'm going to be looking through. It's something you realise afterwards. You need to be quite careful about it, because the first lecture I ever went to from an author teaching you how to write, she talked about the fact that if you've got two people in a room, if you don't stay with one and see everything through their eyes, it ends up a little bit like a tennis match, as the conversation bounces from one person's mind to another person's mind. And the scene immediately coalesces once you've worked out who are you looking through. But then, of course, there are all sorts of things that you have to take account of. Because you're looking through that person's eyes, they may not know what is going on in the other person's head. So they have to work out from a gesture, an expression, reading between the lines. The other thing you can't do is take your viewpoint character and describe them as if they were being seen from the outside. She was looking upset, but you can't say that if the story is going through that one person. So there are all sorts of little pitfalls like that, which is quite interesting. Something that if you are writing that, looking through it afterwards is going to be helpful to think, now, is that working? So from that point of view, that's how I set it up. I also find you have to have a limited number of viewpoint characters. They have to be fairly prominent in the book. You can't just switch every time there's a different person in the scene. But the great thing is you then do get behind the character. And one of the really funny things that happens, you know, as one of the other writers, I can't actually remember offhand who it was, said it sounds a bit woo-woo to say that the characters have a mind of their own. But when you have a familiar viewpoint character, the great thing is when you sit down, you're not sure what they're going to say. I mean, I have one character in my first series, Marjorie Fleming series, Tam McNee, who's a wee Glaswegian policeman. And when I would sit down to write something from Tam's point of view, I'd feel quite excited. Now, I wonder what Tam's going to say today. And he obliged. It is an odd thing. And I was fascinated to find that there are other people talking about that too, when the character takes over.
Yes, thanks. And Ellie, what about you? What's your approach on the question of viewpoint?
I really enjoyed your chapter, Aline, and so interesting because I teach creative writing, as I think we probably all do, and it's something that my students really struggle with, is point of view. And I often say to them, where's the camera? Your analogy of the head going to and fro, like in a tennis match, you know, where's the camera? And they often have quite a lot of trouble in realizing where it is and who's talking, whether you are in the close point of view or whether you are having a bit of an attack of the omniscient narrator, which, as you do say, is probably better avoided most of the time. I mean, you know, it can work. And I do remember recently somebody did a really nice piece of writing for me, and they said, I blushed. And I said to them, well, what's wrong with that? And she couldn't really see it. But of course, the thing is, that's not something you can say about yourself. You can say, I felt myself getting hot. I was worried that I was going red. Oh, I hope I'm not blushing. You can have all those feelings, but you can never say authoritatively, I blushed, because you're not looking. And you know, you don't want to resort to, I mean, we've all read the sort of usually quite terrible bits of writing that involve the point of view person looking at themselves in the mirror and saying, it's been unfair to say this, but it's often a male writer writing a female who looks at themselves in the mirror rather a lot. I'm not going to say further, but in rather sort of gloating way. So I think point of view is really important. And I know for myself and my own work, you know, what works best for me is when I'm stuck, what works best for me is thinking right into that character's point of view. You know, when I'm writing about Ruth, the protagonist of my sort of longest series, what can Ruth see? What at this moment, what is Ruth looking at? And that always helps. So yeah, really fascinating chapter.
Thank you. Well, I certainly find if a scene is really sticky, it's nearly always because you've got the wrong viewpoint character. And very often, if it's been that, it just flows.
I find sometimes that the one of the most crucial choices I have to make when I'm beginning to write a book is that one of viewpoint, that it's often very hard to get right first off. In my case anyway, I'll begin writing the first person thinking, no, that's not going to work, it'll have to be third person, and there's so many variants, you have to try to find the one that feels right for this particular story. It's a big choice, isn't it, what the viewpoint is going to be.
And what's that?
Can I say something just for a sec? I'm thinking about this. David Morrell, you know, broke into crime writing with Rambo, but has actually written many, many things since. It was called First Blood. He and I were sitting in his writer's studio in Santa Fe, and he was really struggling with point of view and character. And some hours later, he came back to me and he said, you know, I've solved it. And I said, wonderful, what did you do? And he said, I renamed him. And just the simple act of renaming the character made a complete difference. And I think it's interesting to think about the freight that we assign to names. You know, maybe it's a person we knew. You know, Bruce is not one of my favorite names, and I have no idea why. Maybe I knew some jerk called Bruce years ago. I really don't know. But there's emotional content to names. And for David, just the simple act of renaming this character freed him up to you know, change him and offer a different point of view than when he had the other name. So I've always really thought that was a tip that deserves more prominence than it gets. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I was just going to say, I think names are really important for a crime writer as well. And I think, Martin, you quote H.R.F. Keating might have had something to say about this, as he had about a lot of things, in that, you know, it's not cheating if, as a crime writer, you always describe a lovely person called Andrew. And the reader...
Why not?
Does, It is a lovely name, Andrew. My husband is also called Andrew. Lovely name. But then they might not associate lovely, suave Andrew with the rather creepy Uncle Andy in the first chapter. And you're not cheating, you know? And it's always a clue as well, isn't it? When somebody calls somebody by a different name. So my husband's nearly always called Andy, but I call him Ollie for a long reason. But, you know, that shows intimacy, doesn't it? So I think you're absolutely right, Barbara. Names are very important.
Well, I wish it were I that were that intelligent. It was actually David Murrell, but I give him credit. The other thing, too, that I find as a reader, I can contribute to this conversation a little bit as a reader and a bookseller, is that it's always a mistake to have similar names in a book. If you've got Jack and John and Jim in one book, the reader is really distracted by that. And I found in books I've edited, I've had to think about that a lot. But I also wanted to offer a comment by an author named Robert Eversoes, who I think is a brilliant writer. I wish it had a longer publishing career. And to be honest, I don't know why he isn't continuing to publish, but somehow he vanished from my universe. But I think this is so true. He said to me, and I repeat it often, that every book exists in three forms. The first one is the one that the author intends to write. It's the book in the author's head. It's the perfect book. And then the second one is the book that actually publishes, the one that the author ended up writing, which doesn't necessarily, in fact, almost never can perfectly match that ideal book that the author intended to write. But the third form, and this one I talk about with my customers a lot, is the book that each person reads, because every single reader brings his or her own experience, his or her own agenda, prejudices. I'm telling you, when you do a lot of these Zoom events and you've got a comment field or a chat field, you could hardly believe some of the comments that go by. When I was talking to Michael Connelly Tuesday night, some guy leapt in and said, well, this book's written in first person, so I'll never read it. And I thought, okay. It's fascinating to talk, to have customers at an event or to run a book club or something and recognize that the book that I read is not really the book everybody's talking about, because each person has personalized and internalized that book. And I think as an author, you have to recognize that, and often authors are surprised at questions and I see them look at me and they go, did I actually write that? Or, they're just astounded that somebody interpreted it in a way that they didn't imagine. So, I think every author has to be true to whatever that original platonic vision of the book was, and not get yourself all worked up about reviews or comments from readers or other things, because there's really no logic to it. It's experiential, or at least I think so. After 35 years, I don't think I'm going to be surprised. And then every once in a while, all over again.
I think it is. It's absolutely right that readers bring their own perceptions. And I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Gallows Court. I've had readers saying, the Me Too movement and the pandemic. Yeah, I wrote the book before I knew anything about Me Too or the pandemic, and it's set in 1930 anyway. So it's quite a surprise when people see these things that the author didn't intend. But of course, it happens all the time in different ways, and we do it ourselves as readers with books that we find fascinating. And this question of perspective is not just about the perspective of the character. It's about the perspective of the readers too. In the Dorothy L. Sayers chapter in How Done It, the book that she discusses in correspondence, it's a series of extracts from letters, is a book called The Documents in the Case. And she explains how she draws from the experience of Wilkie Collins writing The Woman in White and The Moonstone in having the different viewpoints. So she does it in the form of documents rather than separate chapters, but again, it's the idea of utilising a particular approach to viewpoint and doing so with quite a lot of the imagination. Now the author's life is really full of so many of these unexpected developments, whether it's what a reader thinks about your book, good or bad, or anything else. And one of the things we wanted to do with How Done It was not just to talk about the nuts and bolts of the craft of writing, but also to talk about the writer's life and all kinds of variations. So there's material about the short story, radio scripts, how to please an editor, great chapter by Antonio Hodgson, and so on. And there are also sections dealing with the problems that writers encounter. Because the writing life is not entirely straightforward all the time, as we all know. It comes as a surprise to some readers, but it's a fact. And so members of the Deception Club have talked about their experiences, the ups and downs, the issue of writer's block. Is there such a thing? And if so, how do you deal with it? Can you use improvisation techniques to get over some of the plot problems we've been talking about? Stella Duffy writes a great chapter on that subject. Mark Billingham recalls his experience as a stand-up comedian and draws a parallel between what the writer does and what a stand-up comic does in terms of timing of a revelation or a punchline, that sort of thing. And again, reading all these manuscripts, I was absolutely gripped, as I'm sure readers of the book will be. And we don't neglect either the practical side of things. And of course, like it or loathe it, one of the practical sides of being a commercially published author is marketing. It's a very important thing. It's all very well to write a book, but it also needs to be sold. And Ellie, you contributed to How Done It, a fantastic chapter on social media. Amongst other things, I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about your approach and your experiences and your feelings on that topical subject.
I have to say, my children laughed themselves stupid when they heard that I was writing about social media. But I think I absolutely was not writing. Just because I call it the interweb doesn't mean I don't know what it is. I absolutely wasn't writing from the position of an expert, but as a writer who just isn't an expert, but just wants to do the best for their book. And, you know, I was thinking, well, nowadays you can't just write a book. You have to promote it and you have to really put yourself out there. But then when I started to think about it, I thought, this isn't new. And of course, Charles Dickens did these amazing lecture tours. And it was, in fact, an over-enthusiastic rendering of the death of Nancy that reputedly killed him. So he was actually killed by promoting his book. And that's why my chapter's called Social Media and the Death of Nancy. So I did want to look at it. You know, you've written the book. What can you do? In some ways, what is the easiest path, you know, to promoting your book, that the minimum that we can do, you know, put something on Facebook, put something on Twitter, put a nice picture on Instagram. And I do it in the book, and it's probably fitting that my cat has interrupted so many times, that black tail you keep seeing coming to and fro, because I've said get a cat or get an animal, because people will like to see your book, but to be honest with you, they will so much prefer to see your cat or your cat with your book. Or any cat, you know, or any dog. So just get an animal, sit it next to your book, and people love it. People love to see you, but I'm sorry to say they prefer to see your animal. And there are some quite funny stories in the chapter, and one which is one that Simon Brett told me, which, you know, we all go out there, you know, promoting our book, and we hope to see a room full of smiling faces. And one of the things about Zoom is we can't see the people who are out there, but we just hope they are out there. Hello, everyone. But Sam Brett was telling a story about an author who was on a tour, I think a foreign tour, an embassy, British embassy tour. And he got to the place and there was only one person there. And he said to the guy, look, there's only you and me. Why don't we just go to the pub and you can ask me anything you want to ask me? And the man said, no, you must do your talk. And the author realised that this guy had been employed to play the piano in the interval. He had to do the talk just for the pianist. So, you know, we've all done these things. We've all done things. We've gone and there'd just been one or two people there. But I suppose my chapter's a little bit about what you can do and just the basics of doing it. I've said, you know, go on Twitter or Facebook and don't talk about your book. Try and talk about your friends' books, because then it will make you look like a lovely person, as I'm sure you all are. But the nice thing is then your friends will talk about your book and it's just a bit more interesting. So it really is just the basics, how to promote your book without killing yourself doing an over-enthusiastic rendition of someone's death.
Aline, how about you? How do you feel about marketing your own books?
I'm a hopeless marketer. I like talking to people, and I've done a lot of that one way or another. But I'm not good at going to someone and saying, this fantastic book I've written. I can't do it. I was always taught you don't boast about what you've done. And I think that's a terrible handicap. I always think that the people who are really, really pushy get on much, much better. And I know that. And networking, I don't understand. I go to a party and I find somebody who's really interesting, and I should talk to them for about 5 minutes, and then move on to find somebody else. And I never do. I tend to sort of go on in the conversation because it's interesting, with the result that I leave having met three people, as opposed to the 25 I ought to have met for the purposes of promotion. But the talks, as long as there is somebody sitting there, you feel you have to do something about it. And my great consolation was once being in Waterstones in Piccadilly, and Penny Vincenti, who at that time was at the top of all bestseller lists, was sitting there alone with piles of books. And I thought, oh, well, it can happen to her. It's not so bad when there's a small audience for me. But I love libraries. I do really love library talks. The people in libraries are always lovely and great fun. And you can really get a very personal relationship with them, whereas you can't with a huge audience. I'm certainly not good at promotion. I've been forced rather reluctantly onto it.
Have you got a cat?
Sorry?
Have you got a cat?
I don't have a cat. I used to have a Dalmatian. Now, if I'd been able to bring my Dalmatian, that would have been simply wonderful. But alas, that was a good while ago.
Andrew, how about you? What's your approach to marketing? Or is it something you think about much?
I suppose increasingly. I mean, I think when I started, my first novel came out in 1982, and marketing was a dirty word then. Publishing was still more or less in the sort of late 19th century in many ways, and authors were not expected to go out and sell themselves, certainly not in the UK anyway. But gradually, even with my sort of slow intelligence, I realized I had to do this sort of stuff. And so I began to do libraries and bookshops and so on. And then along came the interweb, as you call it. And indeed I call it too sometimes, which opened things up quite a lot, doesn't it? Twitter and Facebook, Instagram even, mean you can connect on some sort of level with an awful lot of people right across the world. And I really, really like that. I find I fairly soon got to the point where I realized that for me, I just can't do the direct sell. Here's my book, buy it and I'll love you forever, that sort of thing. I can't do that. I don't think it works very well. And I think this may be a cultural thing. But what I can do is I can talk to people. I like talking to people. And a writer's life, as we all know, has its solitudes. And it's lovely to get out there and talk to people. I really, really enjoy that. And one of the great joys of a live audience is when it starts bouncing back at you, and you realize you're not just talking to people, you're in a conversation. It's great, actually. I really like that. And even on Twitter sometimes you connect with people and you end up having a conversation with something quite bizarre. It's got nothing to do with your book, but hey, it's fun. And I like to think that if you don't sort of ram home your marketing message too much, it's actually a more effective way of selling yourself and your books. What you're selling, certainly on Twitter and Facebook, is almost you as a person, rather than your product. And once people begin to invest in a particular author, in the sense they can chat on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, they begin to think, well, I'll read the book too. I'll buy the book because I know this person. It makes it personal. But I think it's terribly hit and miss. And I think one should only do what you enjoy doing. I mean, the writer's life is such a weird thing anyway, but I if I've learned one thing is that there's no point in doing things you don't enjoy. It just doesn't work out in the end.
And in the end, and I do say that in the article, in the end, the only thing that only we can do is write the book. So yes. We do have to concentrate on that. And I totally agree with you, with both of you, really. It's just more fun to actually have a conversation, isn't it? And I do love that when suddenly an event, like Aline, I love going to libraries or bookshops, when an event suddenly becomes a chat. But you can sometimes have that on sort of Twitter or something. And I've got two words to say to you, Barbara, about Bruce. Bruce Springsteen.
You know, his actual lead guitarist is one of my best customers, so I know.
Oh my gosh!
Nils Lofgren loves her.
Let
me follow up what Andrew, what you were all talking about. You know, as writers, what really makes you distinctive and what bonds readers to you is voice. It doesn't really matter what the character is because the voice can change, but you know, to really enjoy a book, it's about the voice. It's about the character speaking to the reader in such a way that a bond is formed. I've just been through this talking to Lee Child and his brother, Andrew. We did the launch for the Sentinel, and part of that conversation was Andrew trying to work out the Reacher voice and taking it over himself. But if you think about it, we found our first video not long ago when we were cleaning out the back room of the Poison Pen, and it was made in 1995, and it was with Phyllis James, who had arrived at the store, and the crowd was such an overflow that in desperation, I got a local TV station to show up and video it so people outside could watch it, which was really upsetting to her. And I had to draft an affidavit in our back room that it would never be shown in her lifetime after this evening, because she was still in her rain gear, poor woman. I mean, she never even got a chance to go to her hotel. But anyway, we've been doing it since 1995. So the only thing we've had to learn in the pandemic was Zoom, which is a much better tool, I have to say, than Skype and the other things that were available to us. But what we have learned over 31 years of talking to literally thousands of authors is that you must do it in your most natural voice. You just have to be you. And any artifice or any attempt to try to be somebody else, to talk down to people, talk up to people as the case may be, is always wrong. And so I really never started out to become a facilitator of conversations. I started out to be a bookseller just for fun. It's a not-for-profit bookstore, and so it really is just for fun. But boy, have I learned that in order to do a good job selling a book, promoting a book, my job is to really help the authors bring the author's voice to the reader, sometimes through me, sometimes directly. And I think Zoom is an absolutely remarkable. Look at the way we're all together. We would never have been able to do this without this technology, right? We're all in different places, I'm in America, you're in the UK, you're in different places in the UK. I've done events with, you know, Australian and other, you know, authors all around the world in just one video. The hardest part's been to explain time zones. Nobody can figure out time zones. I've actually had somebody the other day ask me if I would do a lunch for a UK author, and could we do it at 5 so the author only had to stay up till 1 a.m. And I wrote back and said, there's no reason to punish the author like that. We'll just do it at noon. It doesn't matter, you know, in a virtual event. It really doesn't matter what time it is, because it's really the after views. It's not the number of people watching it at the time. It's the number of people who will watch it overall that has that effect. And it's like you throw a ball out there and it just bounces. You cannot control what happens when you do that. You know, how many people will pick it up and throw it to somebody else or refer it and all. So there's a whole exponential growth thing that goes on that we just marvel at it. We truly do. We did an event not long ago, a book discussion follow-up to a best-selling author because he was so frustrated. We couldn't talk about the end of his book during his launch because, you know, we'd have been lynched for spoilers and so forth. So I said, let's just do one 3 months later and then we can talk about the whole book. And a man from New Zealand sent me an email and he said, I don't think I can stay up long enough to do this, but I want my question asked. So please ask the author this question. And while we were talking, there were people from Bulgaria. There was somebody from Karachi. There was somebody from Perth. All fans of this author who writes international bestsellers, all coming together. So there's an entirely new world of promotion now available to us. And the question I'm always asked is, you know, are you going to keep any of this?
Yeah.
The answer is we are. You know, I hope we can go back to live events. There's nothing more fun than a whole room full of people talking to authors and, you know, the whole back and forth dynamic that Andrew's talking about. It's wonderful. But I think that we can do amazing things by keeping this technology as part of it. So, you know, it's been a tough slog and it's hard for people who resist it. So my advice to every author would be try to embrace this as best you can, because it really is a remarkable tool.
Yeah, well,
it's also fun. It's also fun, isn't it? I mean, I'm meeting people. It's great. It's lovely. I've seen more of Ellie this way, I think, than I've ever seen via Zoom.
We've done a few events together, haven't we?
Yeah, it really is. Andrew and I caught up not long ago after several years of not seeing each other. We did a different Zoom chat, and Ellie, I really wanted to do one with you because you have so many readers who have never had a chance to talk. This is what, our fifth in the last couple of months?
I'd love that. Yeah, I really would. Yes, it's so much fun, isn't it? And it's sort of magical, isn't it? But here we all are.
Indeed we are. So congratulations to all of you. I think this is a remarkable book that you all have put together. And Martin, I did want to ask you, in fact, I'd like to ask all of you as the final question. I mentioned that the Detection Club is a social club, but I know that Andrew anyway, and you, Martin, certainly, also belong to the Crime Writers Association, which I do belong to since 1990. What is the difference between the Crime Writers Association and the Detection Club? Because we have a lot of customers who ask for that.
Well, the essential difference is that the Crime Writers Association is a professional organization. So if you are eligible to join because you've published a crime book or done certain other things in the field, then you apply to join and you become a member. And it's a large and successful organisation. The Detection Club is and has always been a small group that is essentially a social club, a dining club. And it began very small in 1930 with 20 members or so, and has remained quite a small group because of its nature as a small social group. But it's a very cohesive one, and that I think is the secret of its astonishing longevity. And I did want to say particularly before we finish how grateful I am to everybody who's contributed. It's quite extraordinary when you look at the roster of contributors, Ellie, Andrew, Aline, but all the others as well, Val McDermid and Rankin and Tweeds, and then the likes of Len Dayton, John Le Carré, and many, many more. And they've all done it for free to help the Detection Club keep going. And that's something I'm enormously grateful for. And the same is true of the estates of the deceased authors, whether it's Agatha Christie or P.D. James. I mentioned Chris James earlier. She was the piece by her about landscape in the book and the sales estate and so on. They've all done it to support the Detection Club, and I'm really quite bowled over. The book, as people have noticed, is quite a large volume. It's much larger than I envisaged at the time of pitching the idea, but I'm absolutely thrilled with it. It's been a fascinating experience putting it together. Everybody has come together in the collegiate way that, in my experience, Crime Writers always do. It's been quite wonderful, and I hope and I feel confident that the readers who look at this book will find it equally satisfying and equally enjoyable.
That would be fair to say that the CWA is the place that you would look for more professional support in terms of publication or promotion or some such thing. And the Detection Club would be more for fellowship to sort of nourish you as a writer, nourish your inner life. Andrew, do you look at it that way? Since I've known you for so long and I know you belong to both.
I think the Crime Writers Association, I mean, it's very much a sort of a group of working writers which anyone can join. It's open to everyone if, as Martin said, you've met certain criteria, usually published a crime novel. But the Detection Club is different. It's very hard to explain. I mean, you, Barbara, you've been to some of the dinners. You know the flavour. It's deeply eccentric. It's invitation only. In fact, it's, you know, members vote to have new members. You have to be clubbable. You've got to be a good writer. You've got to be clubbable. I like to think of it as a sort of House of Lords of crime writing, whereas the CWA is merely the messy old House of Commons. You know, we're the creme de la creme, you could put it.
Well, you don't you
speak for yourself on this,
a CWA meeting, that's for sure. My vivid memory is the skull. And
oh, yes,
Simon and the Skull, which you would not run into at your ordinary CWA meeting, which I have been to too. Aileen, I need to say I'm sorry we've never met before, so I feel as though I've directed some comments that leave you out unfairly, and it's only because we just don't have any history together. So I do apologize. I have read all your books and sold all your books. Indeed, that would be the case for all of you here. So that's been wonderful. I'm going to leave you with one final memory of my experience with the Detection Club. Some years ago, when Harry Keating was still alive, I spent a night having dinner at the Keatings and then was escorted up to the third floor bedroom where I was going to spend the night. And after I crawled into bed, I looked around me and realized I was actually there in the Detection Club library. And unable to resist that, I went to the shelves and pulled down a copy of Gaudy Night, autographed by Dorothy L. Sayers. And I sat up all night reading this wonderful book. And before I went down to breakfast, it was a real test. I thought to myself, I could just chuck it in my suitcase and walk out. And I said to Harry when I left, I said to him, you know, it says a lot for your view of human nature that you haven't frisked me as I'm going out the door. that was a remarkable evening, and I do think the Detection Club is very special. Clubbable is really not an American word; it's a very British word, and kind of a British concept, Andrew. But I think it's a wonderful one. So, thank you all for joining me today. We will certainly do our best at the Poison Pen to sell loads of copies of How Done It. They should arrive, in fact, on Monday for Tuesday publication. And I wish you a success in all the goals that you set for yourself when you started this project. Martin, you have been truly remarkable. Since you retired, I have never known anybody that has worked as hard on behalf of all authors and yourself as you have. And I want to congratulate you again as the winner of this year's Diamond Dagger, just a remarkable award. And I hope for your sake that when it comes around next year that you will get to actually have a real live person. I hope they'll let you share it with a 2021 winner. Don't you think that would be fair, everybody?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. We should all lobby for that, I think. Anyway, thanks. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Night. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.